to each one, and we welcome you all here. You visitors, we're glad for your presence here today. And above all, we're glad for the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit, who the promises will guide us into all truth. And so we're going to look at his word for truth this morning. And I have an assignment that I need to take up tonight in another congregation. And so we're going to have a test drive right here. And it's actually a question that's in the Bible. And so maybe we'll just have a little drill or quiz this morning. And it's a question, and here's the question. Shall we smite with the sword? Is the question. Does anybody know where that's found? Maybe we ought to break it down. Can anyone tell me if that's Old Testament or New Testament? New Testament, okay. What about the instance, or where was the question asked, or when was the question asked? In the garden. It was in the garden. Turn to Luke chapter 22. We don't know who asked the question. Luke 22 and verse 49. We're just going to read verses 47 to 53 out of Luke 22. Beginning at verse 47. And while he yet spake, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? When they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? And one of them smote the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. And Jesus answered and said, suffer ye thus far. And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said unto the chief priests and captains of the temple. Then Jesus said unto the chief priests and the captains of the temple and the elders which were come to him, be ye come out against a thief with swords and staves? When I was daily with you in the temple, ye stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. I'd also like to turn back to John chapter 18 and read the verses here in John 18. All the Gospels record a certain portion of this, but we're not going to turn to all of them. I would like to read verses 1 through 11 here in John 18. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Cedron, where was a garden, into the which he entered and his disciples. And Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oft-times resorted thither with his disciples. Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, whom seek ye? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus saith unto them, I am he. And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. As soon then as he had said unto them, I am he, they went backward and fell to the ground. Then asked he them again, whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I have told you that I am he. If therefore ye seek me, let these go their way, that the saying might be fulfilled which he spake of them which thou gavest me, have I lost none. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it, and smote the high priest's servant, and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Then said Jesus unto Peter, put up thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it? And we'll stop there. I was given this assignment a few months ago, and I know I preached before on non-resistance. I don't remember when, I didn't go looking, but this topic is to be about non-resistance. And they chose this, not sure why they chose this question. So I'd like to first of all just think a little bit more about the story and the happenings before we get into. I found it more difficult to actually get as practical as I would have liked on this topic. So again, I'm open to your suggestions and alterations before I go to preach it tonight again. So the setting is this, that, and I'm assuming this is very familiar to us, and so I'm starting at that point, that Judas has left the group when they had the Last Supper and feet washing. Somewhere in that window, he left the upper room and went out. We remember that. And it was known at that point that he was betraying Jesus. And Jesus, I think it says, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, he says that in the story at one point, that he then leaves with his disciples and goes to, well, some of the Gospels say Mount of Olives, and some say Gethsemane, and it seems like it may have gone to Mount of Olives first, which is real close to the Garden of Gethsemane. But then they went to this place of solitude, I believe. They, obviously, with some of the wording that we read, he says he resorted there other times. That's how I believe Judas knew where to find him, because this was probably a common place where Jesus and his followers went. Maybe I'm assuming too much, but I believe they may have gone there in the past to escape the crowds, or just spend some time alone in prayer. This does not seem like an out of the normal activity for Jesus and his disciples. And at some point in this, there's some of the Gospels we didn't read. He said, pray that you enter not in temptation. And he went apart and prayed and came back and found them sleeping. You know that part of the story as well. But at some point, he told them that betrayal was imminent, in my own words, that this, we must go now because the hour has come. And they began to leave this garden and they, to meet the group that Jesus already knew was coming. And this group here, verse 47, says, and while he yet spake, behold, a multitude. Calls it a multitude that Judas was bringing with him. I don't know who they thought they were going to find or what kind of resistance they thought they were going to find. I'm sure that Judas knew that it was only Jesus and 11 men, but here comes a multitude. And I can picture they were likely, this was dark, we know this was dark. They were probably carrying torches. I suppose that's the type of light they would have had, torches held high over their heads as they were walking to illuminate as much as possible. And they found Jesus and his remaining 11 disciples. And we know the dialogue Judas and Jesus had. Judas had already told the group, that he's going to betray you. I will show you the man because it's the man that I'm going to kiss. And he is the one that we need to take. I don't know if it was that dark or why, because I'm almost sure that all these men that were with would have seen Jesus at some point in time. I'm not sure why they needed a sign as to who they were after, because I don't think Jesus was a stranger. Likely he was not a stranger to any of these. But when they answered Jesus' question, when he said, who are you looking for? And they said, well, we're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. And then he said, I am he. There appears to have been a display of power, only similar to how to think right away of the one at the resurrection or at the tomb when the men, it says they became as dead men. It doesn't say that about these men, but there was a display of power that they fell over backward. But they still they came to take him. And I just had to think about the whole human element of seeing that all happen before you and experiencing that power from this one man. But still we charge forward. We go forward to take this man, this group of men, Judas and his men, we're going to take him. In spite of this display of power. Now is when the question was asked there in verse 49. Lord, shall we smite with the sword? And this smite was not, it was just an ordinary smack. Like we were swatting a fly off of you. It was this word smite, actually smiting with a sword. This was combat. And well, like I said, we don't know who raised the question. I don't even know if commentaries assume that Peter asked. We know that Peter did the smiting, but we don't know who asked the question. And this move was intended to defend and protect the group. This question, again, was not just to try and scare these people off. This was actually a defensive move. But the other thing we see is that whoever asked the question, Peter did not wait for an answer. He charged right in and just smote off the high priest's servant's ear. And I don't know if it was skill on Peter's part or if he actually intended to crack him in the middle of the skull. I don't know. We have no way of knowing that. But he just caught his ear. But this was an offensive move to defend Jesus. Peter didn't wait for this answer. Did he know what Jesus was going to say? Who was that? Jesus said to, "Have I been so long time with you, and yet hast thou not known me, Philip?" I think he asked the question. And I think Jesus was likely asking Peter that right then, probably in his mind, even though he wasn't asking him. "Do you not know what the answer is? Shall we smite the sword? Have we not been together all these years, all this time, giving you so much teaching, and you still don't know the answer to this?" Did Jesus remain silent on purpose? Perhaps his silence or not answering was meant to speak to the men. I'm speculating, we don't know, but whatever the reason, combat was used. And Peter went ahead and attempted to protect the very man. Peter felt it was his duty to try and protect the very man who, just by saying the words, "I am he," caused a whole group of men to fall over. Now, how ironic or how opposite is that? What was Peter's thought process? We already know, if you read one of the other Gospels, it says that they had two swords. There's only two swords, and what was that to the approaching multitude who was carrying staves and other things? The Bible tells us there in verse 52, with swords and staves, this whole multitude had these instruments with them. Jesus instructed the men to put the sword in its sheath, put the sword back where it belonged. So why shouldn't Peter use the sword? What was wrong with using the sword? I believe Peter likely knew that for years God's own people defended themselves against other wicked nations by using the sword. God's people were called to defend themselves in the face of wicked men many times. Now, if you're still in John 18, I'd like to read verses. It's a little bit fast-forwarding in the story. We're not going to talk about this part anymore, but 35 and 36, I want you to notice the answer. Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew, thine own nation, and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me? What hast thou done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence." Jesus answered Pilate that the reason he was brought before him was because his kingdom was not a part of this world. And Peter himself was demonstrating right before that he believed this was an earthly kingdom. Jesus' kingdom is poles apart is from the earthly kingdom. It's not of this world. So what was Peter's condition, and maybe other of the disciples, what was their personal condition at this time, at this happening? I don't know if we know for sure, but if you turn back to Luke 22, where we had first started reading, I'd like to go back just a few verses before verse 47 and read verses 31 to 34. Thinking about this group of men that was with Jesus and what, at least we get a window into Peter's heart here. "And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not. And when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. And he said unto him, Lord, I am ready to go with thee, both into prison and to death. And he said, I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me." We know that Peter had been right along there with Jesus for several years, and he had been taught by Jesus himself. But apparently he had not allowed these teachings to affect his heart. Because I take it from the words there in verse 32, Jesus said, "When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." I don't believe that Peter's heart, that Peter had a changed heart. Even though he was following the Master, I don't believe Peter had a changed heart at this point. We know at the end of, towards the end of the story, before the crucifixion, after the cock did crow three times, or after the cock did crow twice, after Peter denied him three times, it says he went out and wept bitterly. I believe that's when his conversion began. Right when he, after he got done denying Jesus those three times, his true conversion began. But I don't believe it was completed until over in Acts chapter 10, when the Lord was trying to prepare him for Cornelius coming in, and the Lord, he had the vision of the animals, the unclean, clean, the unclean animals, and he was told, "Arise, Peter, kill and eat." He said, "No, I can't, because they're unclean." But that was, and I believe that is when Peter's conversion was completed, when he finally learned or knew that Jesus was not just for the Jewish, but he was also for the Gentile. Now, probably the foundational teaching of non-resistance is found in Matthew 5, so we'll turn there. Likely familiar verses, but I'd like to read a few verses, four or five verses out of Matthew 5. We'll read verses 38 to 42. And I am pretty sure Peter was here for this, because verse 1 tells us that his disciples came unto him after he had set himself down. Verse 38 to 42 of Matthew 5. "Ye have heard that it hath been said." So here we have the old way, the Old Testament. "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." And if you were to look that up, there's numerous references in Leviticus and other in the Old Testament where this was taught. "But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away." So this is the teaching of Jesus on non-resistance. And it was foreign to them, and we know that even at the time in the Garden of Gethsemane, it was still foreign to some of them there, and that's why Peter took a hit, or made a hit with his sword. Whoever, and I don't, probably somebody knows this here, and I didn't go looking for it, but the full, whoever wrote or compiled the Martyr's Mirror understood something about the teachings of Jesus, because the full title, I had to go looking for it, but I was pretty sure I knew the full title of the Martyr's Mirror is The Bloody Theater or Martyr's Mirror of the Defenseless Christians, who baptized only upon confession of faith and who suffered and died for the testimony of Jesus their Savior from the time of Christ to the year AD 1660. That's the full title. The part I wanted was Defenseless Christians. That is Jesus' teaching. "Ye have heard that hath been said, but I say unto you that resist not evil." Resisting not is a defenseless person, a person that doesn't hold up a defense. So what does that mean? How can we be practical about shall we smite with the sword? It's somewhat foreign to us. Or is it? We're not tempted. I'd be shocked if any of us here are tempted to use the sword to take someone's life. I don't think that's even a temptation to us. But what does Jesus say? Jesus says, "Whoso looketh on a woman to lust after her." So what does that tell us? The thought, the process, the thinking. Do our thoughts ever violate Jesus' standard? When are we most tempted? When are you most tempted with the temptation to not be non-resistant? Or when are you tested with being resistant? In this story today, several times, and I don't know the answer, but as I was studying, I was thinking about this. Several times Jesus said, "Pray that ye enter not into temptation," he told the disciples. Was it the temptation to be resistant? It could have been. It was likely also the temptation to flee and run away and not identify with him at this rough hour, at this tough time. I believe it could have been both. So how are we tempted to abandon Jesus' teachings and begin choosing the other kingdom's methods? I have a few I'll try to hurry through. I would just like to pull back. I don't know that my focus is supposed to be on Peter, but I guess I'm going to be focusing on Peter. Right then, with the sword on his side, I suppose, in its sheath, we're tested, just like Peter was, when defense makes sense. It made sense for Peter to protect the man that he loved by whipping out his sword. We are tested when defense makes sense. It made total sense to these disciples, or else the question would never have been raised. And we've been called out from the world to be a follower of Jesus. We're called out, if we are a follower of Jesus, we've been called out from the world's methods. Peter grabbed the sword to use the world's method of defense. And because we are called out and called to a different kingdom, the methods that we use today do not make sense to the people that use defense as their method. What we do about not resisting will not make sense to your neighbors. I know I talked about this before, and I don't want to belabor it, but unfortunately, the things I remember are personal illustrations, and that is when those cooler panels got stolen from us. It became obvious to me that in the minds of the local police, I was very foolish. And I'm going to tell you, I was tempted to feel foolish because they were shaking their heads, two men shaking their heads at my foolish decision not to press charges. And I began to feel foolish. I was tempted to feel foolish because the kingdom that I was identifying with of not resisting was not making sense whatsoever with the kingdom that says, oh yes, we do resist. This is not fair. Defense makes sense. So when defense makes sense is where we're tested. So is it right to use a collection agency, or is that resisting? Someone owes you money that you desperately need, and so it makes sense to use the defenses that are available. Will you use an attorney to write a letter to send a weighty document to someone? Oh no, we don't call it a threat, but you know, it's defense that we are needing. Will you stoop to putting pressure on someone as long as it doesn't go to court? I had the privilege several years ago of teaching the doctrine of non-resistance in Bible school. And so I pulled this book out, and I'm going to read you two stories. And I know probably most all of you here from the ages of 20 to 30 have studied this book, but some of the rest of you have not. When defense makes sense is what I'd like to just read this short story. Benedict Miller, an Amish bishop, lived in Somerset County, Pennsylvania in the early 1800s. One night, someone stole his large gray Percheron workhorse. Even though Benedict saw the tracks of a horse and a man going out his lane, he refused to go after the thief or make any effort to find him. He believed that Jesus' words in Luke 6, verse 30 should be understood literally. And of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. The people in Benedict's community talked of the theft for weeks. They did not understand the ways of this non-resistant follower of Christ. They thought that surely he should have made effort to find the thief. Several months later, a neighbor saw a huge gray horse tied to a hitching rack in Baltimore, Maryland, 90 miles away. Feeling sure that it was Benedict's horse, he spoke to the owner, who stated that he had bought the horse from a stranger a short while earlier. He agreed to sell the horse if it could be proven to be Benedict's horse. But Benedict refused to take the horse back unless he returned on his own, unless the horse returned on his own. Several neighbors went together to buy the horse for Benedict. They led him back from Baltimore. About a mile from Benedict's farm, they removed the horse's bridle. The Percheron slowly headed down the road toward the Benedict farm. At the lane, he turned abruptly and walked straight toward the barn. When he entered the barnyard, Benedict called his name, but the horse ignored him, walked through the barn door and into his own stall. Benedict's horse was home. It made all kinds of sense. Would it have been wrong for Benedict to go to Baltimore and say, hey, buddy, by the way, that is my horse and someone stole it. May I have it? But he did not. He chose Jesus' kingdom rather than the earthly kingdom. Another place that we're tempted or we're tested, and that maybe you're going to say it's very closely related, but it's when defense is needed. In Peter's mind, defense was needed right then, right now. And that's why he didn't wait for an answer from Jesus. I think it's one of the reasons. This problem was looming, and it had to be dealt with right now. Defense was needed. Defense is needed when we have an innocent person who's getting taken unjustly. And that's exactly what was happening. Jesus was getting taken unjustly, and Peter felt it was his problem to deal with. So what is more important? Winning an earthly contest that affects me? Or is it more important to lose an earthly contest so that Jesus can be obeyed? Is it right to contest a new tax assessment? Maybe you're saying I'm going off on the limb. Again, we're not tested with taking the sword. Is it right to contest a new tax assessment? We all went through it, and that's why I had to think of it, well, at least in Blair County, because I was pressured by neighbors to the store when they came wanting to compare notes and found out what we were assessed at. I said, you got to go deal with that. You got to go appeal that thing. I didn't appeal it. I didn't feel it was in my place to appeal it. Should have I appealed it? Would it have been wrong to appeal it? Was defense needed? Is it wrong for me to pay higher taxes than what I really should, perhaps? So when is it right to seek a reduced fine? Or is it right to seek a reduced fine? I had someone recently, now they were not a part of our congregation, they would consider themselves Christian folks, were involved in an accident that was clearly their fault. And they went and went to the district court to get the fine reduced. Would you ever do that? Would it be right for the Christian to do that? Which kingdom are you part of? Are you a defenseless Christian? What does Jesus teach? Another place that we're tested is to resist when rights are being revoked. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. Now we have the converted Peter giving us some instruction, some teaching. When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. And here we go. Peter's going to strengthen us. 1 Peter 2, verses 19 to 23. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. But what glory is it, if, when ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently? But if, when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow in his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. So here we have the converted Peter, a different Peter than what we read about in Luke 22. We can and must allow our rights to be affected if we're a follower of Jesus. Those words, take it patiently, means to stay under. And I get the word picture of the inner man just wanting to crop up and say, unfair, unfair, this is not right. Take it patiently means to stay under and to endure, just to let it go. It says this is acceptable with God, and that word acceptable means gratifying. I just thought it was interesting to ponder that for a bit, that when we take it patiently, when we endure it, this actually brings God glory. It says it's gratifying to God. Can God be gratified? This is acceptable. This is gratifying to God. I'm going to read you another story about Jacob's rights. Here's a man who had rights. Some years ago, Jacob, a Mennonite farmer, decided to replace his small chicken house with a larger, modern one. Having gotten the necessary permits, he made plans to begin building. The bulldozer, grader, truck, and tamper moved in and began preparing the site. After getting a good start on the first day, the operators parked their equipment at the end of the field. That evening, Jacob's phone rang several times. "You're not going to build a big chicken house right here in our backyard, are you?" asked one neighbor. "We never hoped that one of those chicken factories would come to our small town," said another. Jacob enjoyed his good neighbors, even though many of them did not profess to be Christians. The small town that his farm bordered provided a quiet, friendly environment for him to raise his family. After a few such calls, Jacob said to his wife, "Maybe we made a mistake. We should have talked to the neighbors before we started." Later that evening, Jacob called the excavator and told him to hold off the digging. "You're not going to stop now, are you? You have all the permits. We've put in a day's work. We'll have to charge you for it and for moving all the equipment." "Just hold off," Jacob replied. I'm not interested in getting my neighbors upset at me." After a few days of talking with the neighbors and asking advice from some of his church brethren, Jacob called the excavator again. "Return the ground to where it was and put the topsoil back again. We're going to make the site into a field again." When the excavator protested, Jacob explained, "Having obtained the necessary permits, I know that I would have the right to continue with the chicken house as we planned, but the law of love compels me to do differently." His rights were being revoked. But Jesus said, "Resist not evil." And Jacob took the higher road. He took God's road. He took Jesus' road. And as I studied this, I looked back in the few times I was tested as I read some of the In America stories. And I have to wonder if I've always lived up to Jesus' standard. I know I have not mentally in my thoughts. I know I've failed in my thoughts. But have I even beyond that? Have you lived up to Jesus' standard of non-resistance? Another thing I got from this story, which is not connected to non-resistance, but I just cannot leave it out. This story in Luke 22. Whoever raised the question that the disciples knew the answer, "Shall we smite with the sword?" It's a very, very dangerous place to be for us to ask a question that we already know the answer. If you ask a question that you already know the answer to, in the world of Jesus' kingdom, and this is not non-resistance only, this is anything. When you ask a question that you already know the answer, I believe many times we can expect defeat. You know, sometimes we believe, we commit ourselves internally we commit and we say, you know what, we would die for the cause of Christ. We would give our lives. But I wonder if we really could. I wonder if I really could if it came to that. Because we have a real difficult time accepting being taken advantage of. I do. You probably do too. You can't be taken advantage of. That really affects us. And we go into this whole mental spin where we're defeated mentally about non-resistance. And it's even worse if it's someone that we perceive as a Christian takes us to the testing point. Do you really believe you could die for the cause of Christ? Do I really believe I could die for the cause of Christ if I fail and my life's not even threatened? Many times in America today, which I think is where our testing is, it just means money, and sometimes it means reputation when we're tested with our non-resistance. There may be more areas. But if we truly have lived and conducted our lives according to Jesus' teachings in his kingdom, our reputation is really not affected by the people that know us the best. It ends up not being affected. I want to read a few more verses, and I know we've got to close. John 15. I want to tell you what Jesus, I want us to read what Jesus said. Jesus said to expect resistance for following him. Verse 18 to 21, if the world hates you, ye know that it hated me before it hated you. If ye were of the world would love his own. But because ye are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. Remember the word that I have said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they know not him that sent me. We can expect resistance. And we could turn to 2 Timothy and read some more verses about trouble that will come if we're going to serve Jesus Christ and serve his kingdom. If we're going to serve the kingdom of his dear son, we can expect resistance. Are you going to resist back, or will you be a defenseless Christian? Matthew 10 and verse 22 says that he that endures, remember that word endured, what did I say that was? Keeping under, staying under, patient endurance. He that endures to the end shall be saved. So let's live lives following Jesus' teaching and be a defenseless Christian. Let's kneel for prayer.